Hi, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with the Arizona Daily Sun for Thursday, August 14th. I'm Flagstaff volunteer reader Lisa Cantor-Ganey, and today our front page articles include firefighters gaining ground on wildfires, whipping up whimsy, and Flagstaff Records hottest start to month of August. And I think we will start with that one. And it's called Flagstaff Records Warmest Start to August in History Before Monsoons Possibly Return. And this is written by Cody Bashour, digital editor. While relief could be on the way for Flagstaff with the first consecutive days of measurable precipitation in nearly 4 weeks, the city just experienced the hottest start to the month of August in history, averaging a maximum high temperature of 88.2 degrees through the first 12 days of the month. 2025's beginning of August surpassed 1995's averaged high of 86.5 for the hottest 12-day beginning to the month on record, with highs still forecast for the high 80s to the low 90s through Thursday. The hottest start might extend to the month's first 2 weeks. Though August 1st reached a high of 84, Flagstaff hit at least 87 degrees for the next 11 days. The stretch included three consecutive 90-degree highs from August 6th through 8th, with two of the days matching the record highs set at least four decades ago. Flagstaff had recorded a total of 45 90-degree days in August in history ahead of this month, but added four more in the past 12 days. In total, 11 of Flagstaff's now 49 90-degree August days have come in the past 6 years, and the recent highs have moved 2025 near the top 10 of highest max temperatures to this point in the year, ahead of 2024, which eventually finished as the second warmest year on record, behind 1932. Temperatures have averaged nearly 8 degrees above normal so far in August, in part because one of the driest starts to the month on record as well. I'm sorry, it's not very grammatical here. That's what it says. Flagstaff has recorded just 0.04 of an inch of precipitation this month, all coming on Sunday, August 10th, while the average is 1.27 inches through the first 12 days of August, trailing only 2020 and 1893's zero precipitation and 1962's trace total through the first 12 days. 2025 is well behind 2024's 1.43 inches of precipitation to this point in the month, falling back to 3.57 inches below normal for the calendar year and 5.11 inches for the season. Flagstaff has seen just 2.12 inches of precipitation since June 15th, the start of the monsoon season, according to the National Weather Service, NWS. Through those 59 days, 2025 ranks as the 19th driest monsoon season, with both 2023 at 1.64 inches 2020 at 1.47 inches, and 2019 at 1.02 inches, all ranking lower for the period as well. taking into account the complete monsoon season, which ends on September 30th, 2020 finished with just 1.78 inches of precipitation, and 2019 ended at 2.08 inches, which 2025 has already surpassed. The NWS office in Belmont had a 50% chance of precipitation on Wednesday, followed by an 80% chance on Thursday, a 70% chance on Friday, and a 50% chance on Saturday, according to Wednesday morning's detailed forecast. Chances of showers remained in the forecast for much of next week, while temperatures dipped back down closer to their normal highs, dropping as low as a projected high of 82 degrees on Friday and Saturday. Temperatures were expected to rise back up to the mid-80s by Tuesday, August 19th. And that front page article was titled, Flagstaff Records Warmest Start to August in History Before Monsoons Possibly Return. And that is written by Cody Bashore, digital editor. And we all hope the monsoons will soon return. Now we're going to move along to our second front page article today. This one is called Firefighters Gaining Ground on Wildfires, but many questions remain over safety and protocol. And this is written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun Staff Reporter. A month after two major fires roared into life in northern Coconino County, the end of active firefighting operations seems to be finally approaching. The White Sage Fire has been contained after burning almost 60,000 acres. And the Dragon Bravo Fire, though still active in some areas, is slowly coming under control. As of Wednesday, containment was up to 44%. What happens next? For the White Sage Fire, the process of post-fire assessment and planning has already begun. A Burned Area Emergency Response, or BEAR, team from the U.S. Forest Service began surveying the burn scar on July 31st, focusing on conditions that could create immediate dangers such as post-fire flooding or debris flows. Paul Brown, the team's leader, said via email that BEAR assessments generally begin before total containment and are completed within about 14 days. A team starts with a map of burn severity generated from satellite imagery of the fire area. It then helps them to focus their on-the-ground evaluations. There is a lot of ground to cover, and the team was working 12 or 13-hour days, according to Brown. Team specialists travel with vehicles to locations where there are critical values that need to be documented and evaluated, Brown explained. Some specialists, such as for heritage and recreation, do considerable travel on foot. If the critical values they are evaluating are in remote areas. One of the major questions in the aftermath of a fire is how the area's hydrological characteristics might have changed. As Flagstaff learned in the wake of the museum, tunnel, and pipeline fires in recent years, a fire's impact on ground cover and soil characteristics can turn previously tame drainages into serious flood hazards. Soil scientists carry equipment in the field, such as a soils knife, to carefully examine soil characteristics, such as root condition and soil structure, Brown said. And a small water bottle to place water drops on the soil to determine if water infiltration characteristics of the soil have been altered from the fire. Their findings help other members of the team generate hydrological models of local watersheds, combining data on soil stability, slope angles, and catchment area to predict runoff, flooding, or sedimentation impacts. In turn, those models help land managers decide what emergency stabilization measures may be needed. Teams also check on the condition of other resources within the fire's footprint, including roads, trails, livestock, infrastructure, such as tanks and fencing, and known archaeological sites. The White Sage Fire Bayer team met with the Kaibab National Forest to provide its recommendations on Monday. At the time of publication, details of those recommendations were not yet publicly available. But the Bayer assessment is only a first step toward understanding of fire's long-term consequences. A lot of the stories written about fire events, or shortly after the fire's done burning, the first few weeks, Kyle Rodman, a research scientist with the Ecological Restoration Institute, ERI, in Flagstaff, said, "We often don't really know the full ecological effects of a fire for a couple of years or more. Depending on the type of vegetation present and the intensity of the fire, resprouting might begin as soon as a few months after the fire dies." Rodman said oaks and aspens are often quick to regrow. But other effects, like delayed or indirect tree mortality, could take years to fully manifest. Although a fire's total acreage is often the most widely shared piece of information, Rodman cautioned that size alone is not necessarily a good indicator of a fire's impact. As an example, he pointed to the two largest fires in Arizona's recorded history. The Wallow Fire, which burned 538,000 acres in 2011, and the Rodeo Chedisky Fire, which burned 468,000 acres in 2002. The Rodeo Chedisky Fire burned pretty severely in a lot of cases, Rodman said. The Wallow Fire was a bit more moderate, but it was actually a bigger event. So if you're thinking about ecological effect, the Rodeo Chedisky probably had a bit bigger ecological effect than the Wallow Fire, just based on the patterns of severity. John Paul Rocafort, another ERI researcher, said his experience conducting post-fire studies has taught him not to assume that all the ground within a fire's footprint will be devastated. In the case of the Dragon Bravo fire, Rocafort said he assumes at least some areas within the perimeter have burned at a relatively low intensity. Maybe the firefighters on the ground have an idea, but my guess is it won't be 100% everything gone type of thing, Rocafort said. Additionally, judging a fire's physical effects requires an understanding of the ecosystem where the fire occurred and how fire historically functioned in that ecosystem. As Rodman put it, is the fire burning within the range of conditions that the forest is capable of dealing with? For the Southwest, where forests are typically adapted to higher frequency but lower intensity fire, one concern is that high severity fires could create very large treeless areas on a scale that is greater than these trees can recover from, Rodman said. If the area of tree mortality exceeds the neighboring tree's seed dispersal range, it might take multiple generations for the forest to regrow in that space, if it happens at all. On the other hand, when wildfire approximates the historical fire regime of an area, it may have beneficial effects, reducing ground fuels and tree density, and thus reducing the likelihood of more intense fire in the future. Whether that will be the case for the North Rim or the Kaibab National Forest remains to be seen. Let it burn? But fire can have political consequences that spill over into ecological ones. It is rare for a prescribed or managed fire to jump containment, happening in fewer than 1% of cases. When it does happen, though, strong negative reactions from the public may prompt land managers to pull back on their use of fire on the landscape. And for national parks in particular, where logging or mechanical thinning activities are often prohibited or tightly restricted compared to other federal lands, that can be an obstacle to effective forest management, Rocafort pointed out. Researchers have found that the most effective method for fuel reduction and fire mitigation is a combination of thinning and burning. If that combination isn't possible, either method alone can be beneficial. Generally, national parks are more reliant upon fire as a tool, Rodman said. They're also more likely to let fires burn. That's been a Park Service policy in place for many years now. Compared to other areas in the Southwest, the North Rim has maintained a highly active fire regime for decades, he added. Rodman understands why escaped fire generates such strong emotions for nearby communities. He has relatives in New Mexico for whom the memory of the Calf Canyon Hermit's Peak fire, a prescribed burn that escaped control in 2022 and became the largest blaze in the state's history, is still fresh. They don't want to see fire used on the landscape at all, he noted. But he hopes the Dragon Bravo fire won't lead to a similar moratorium on the use of managed fire, especially where other methods of fuel reduction are constrained. There is a consensus among fire scientists that increased suppression will ultimately lead to more catastrophic wildfires, not fewer, and that despite the risks, fire is a necessary component of active forest management. It's a really important tool, and it's a really important part of the ecosystems in the West, Rodman said. While the ecological effects of fire may take time to thoroughly assess, the economic impacts of the Dragon Bravo fire have already become apparent. The closure of the North Rim has put a serious dent into seasonal revenue for tourism-dependent businesses in northern Coconino County. Post-fire assessments are likely to be key to determining which areas of Grand Canyon National Park can safely reopen and when. Any elevated risk of accelerated water runoff in the canyon's major drainages could be cause for concern. Phantom Ranch, for instance, is a popular destination or stopover for rim-to-rim hikers, backpackers, mule rides, and rafters. But it also sits at the bottom of Bright Angel Canyon, below the burn scar of the Dragon Bravo fire, and could be vulnerable to flash flooding if the fire has substantially altered the upstream hydrology. Bright Angel Canyon and the ranch have experienced flash floods in the past. So far, park officials have been reticent to speak about any predictions for the future, because this remains a very active incident. There is currently limited information available regarding structural assessments, cultural resource impacts, or long-term recovery planning. Joelle Baird, public affairs officer with the Grand Canyon National Park, wrote in an email on August 4th. Baird did not respond to a follow-up inquiry. And that article's title is Firefighters Gaining Ground on Wildfires, but Many Questions Remain Over Safety and Protocol. And it was written by Sam McLaughlin, Sun staff reporter. Now we're going to move on to our third front page story today. This article is called Whipping Up Whimsy. Father-son team of Flagstaff, John and Adam Conley, combine unexpected flavors in new web series. And this article is written by Calliope J. Ludeker. And there's a picture of the Conleys. A genuine camaraderie establishes on screen as local restaurateur John Conley banters with his son Adam. Time and time again, John tries to sneak a habanero into the food processor, much to the chagrin of Adam, who prefers his salsa on the mild side. Such antics are the basis of the new series, Raid the Kitchen, premiering this month on YouTube. If you know John Conley, you know that he is all about family, food, and giving back to his community, producer Hillary Rankin said. I thought this was a great way to combine all three. In each episode of Raid the Kitchen, John and Adam argue between two dishes to prepare for dinner before settling on a fresh new way to combine them. The duo then proceeds to raid the kitchens of Conley's three restaurants, Salsa Brava, Fat Olives, and Fat Bagels. Adam and John work together on the meal in their outdoor kitchen. Once completed, they enjoy the fruits of their labor, with Adam assigning a rating to each concoction. The episodes are equal parts heartwarming and hilarious. One of the things we forget is this idea of inclusion and how we all get to play a part in everybody's lives, John said. Adam, who has Down syndrome, is willing to cook or try anything. Part of this YouTube channel is to show people that we're all different, but we're all the same. They have a fun, playful relationship on camera, Rankin said, reflecting on Adam's love of theater and his notable ongoing gag. He loves to pretend he's burning himself. He loves making people smile and laugh. Not at any point in the six episodes that we shot did Adam actually burn himself. I make it more like an Adam and John show, Adam said. I'm not acting, I just improvise. Rankin met John nearly a decade ago when working on Guy's Grocery Games, a series John has appeared on 11 times. Over cameras and cooking, the two established a close friendship. I've sat behind the camera and interviewed him for hours upon hours, Rankin said. Raid the Kitchen came to fruition when Rankin showed John a YouTube project she worked on with another chef. The encounter got the wheels turning in John's mind. With the help of producing partner Steve Pilot of Otto Pilot Productions and John's supplier, Shamrock Foods, they got to work on their idea. The hope is we can create a revenue stream that will provide financial stability to a long-term independent living home for young adults like Adam with developmental disabilities, John said. We've already purchased the home. Now we're trying to develop a revenue stream that will secure its future. That's the whole purpose of this. Despite the absurdity of the dishes conceived, such as lobster bagel Benedict and mussel pot pie, John and Adam are proud of what they were able to create. And those sound good. All six dishes were really killer, John said. I have worked on over 100 episodes of cooking shows in my career as producer. This is the best food that I've seen consistently, Rankin said. Not only does it look good on camera, but we got to try it as a crew, and everything was so dang tasty. After an episode is filmed, Rankin compiles the process into a recipe and shares it alongside the completed video. We premiered the chicken parm burrito last Friday, and I had four people contact me and say, "Guess what we made last night," John said. That's about as much joy as you can get out of a cooking show. Moving forward, John's goal is to populate the YouTube channel with many more clips featuring himself and his family. These will include simple tutorials and tips for the kitchen as he strives to make cooking as accessible as possible. That's what I like about this production. Anybody can make it. We're not cooking with tweezers. This isn't complicated. It's fun, it's entertaining, and it's stuff you can do in your home, John said. It's just cooking from the heart with my son and soon to be my whole family. Growing up as a chef's son, Adam is no stranger to cooking. Oftentimes, stealing the show with his comedic finesse, he enjoys the process just as much as his father. He told me that it feels like he's back in the kitchen cooking with his family, Rankin said. Episodes of Raid the Kitchen are released weekly on John's YouTube channel at www.youtube.com/@JohnnyBravaTV. John said subscribing to the channel allows viewers to be informed as soon as new content is released. When you subscribe, you don't pay anything. All that does is give you a front row seat to see the content and get notifications, John said. Raid the Kitchen showcases not only the importance and ease of cooking at home, but also the beautiful reality of embracing every person as their own individual. Everyone has a part. We're all human. It's really more about everyone coming together, Adam said. We're just human and want to be treated the way everyone wants to be treated. It's about inclusion. We're all humans living a human existence on planet Earth. We all need to be included. I really believe that, John added. Our long-term hope is to share our love of cooking with the community, and the community is everywhere. And that article was called Whipping Up Whimsy, Flagstaff Father-Son Team, John and Adam Conley, Combine Unexpected Flavors in New Web Series. And this was written by Calliope J. Ludeker, Sun staff reporter. And I'll just take this time to remind you that you're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun. from the Flagstaff Studios of Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds programming is directed to those who cannot use print materials due to a disability. Listen to our live streams and learn how you can support us at the website sunsounds.org. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand. From our website, choose Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. Now we're moving on to the local and Arizona page where we have some obituaries to read. The first is for Dr. Richard Earl Doc Wright, 87, of Flagstaff, Arizona, who suddenly left this world and went home to the Lord on Sunday night, August 3rd, 2025. He was 87 years of age, having been born March 25, 1938, in Creston, Ohio, to parents Leland and Iola Boehner Wright. He joined the Army in 1957, and after 3 years of enlistment, he pivoted to serve for another 9 years with the Army National Guard. He also enrolled in Cleveland Chiropractic College. And after graduating in 1966, he created and opened one of the most successful chiropractic practices in Southern California. Dr. Wright closed his practice in 1998, and after relocating to Flagstaff, he and his wife Dagmar co-founded the Science of Life Institute and the Wright Ministry, where he was actively involved in the research of wellness and longevity. He was passionate about helping people realize their natural potential, deal with stress more appropriately, and discover inner peace through Christianity. Richard is survived by his beloved wife, Dagmar Wright, sons Michael with Paula Wright of Castaic, California, Kenneth with Andrea Wright of Brandon, Florida, and Richard with Megan Beiler of Houston, Texas, daughters Kimberly Wright of Irvine, California, and Tiffany Beiler of Baltimore, Maryland, six grandchildren, Connor, James, Amanda, Andrew, Caitlin, and Hazel, brother Burl Burt with Jean Chapman of Simpsonville, South Dakota. A celebration of life service has been scheduled for August 15, 2025. Arrangements provided by Lozano's Flagstaff Mortuary and Crematory on 4th Street in Flagstaff. Call Lozano's at 928-774-1467 for times and additional details. Then we have next an obituary for Eriko Akugawa Starley. It was with great sadness that we announced the passing of Eriko Akugawa Starley on July 27, 2025. Eriko was a resident of Flagstaff, Arizona, but a citizen of the world. Born in Shiga, Japan on August 20, 1964, Eriko was an artist, teacher, and mentor to many. She was a beloved wife, sister, daughter, sister-in-law, and aunt. She is survived by her mother, Harua Okugawa, brother, Jun Okugawa, and husband, Steve Starley. She will be deeply missed. A memorial service will be held later this fall. And our last obituary here today is for Mark Stevenson, who was born July 1st, 1952 in Hinsdale, Illinois. He is the son of Henry and Grace Stevenson. Mark left Illinois in his 20s with a friend on a motorcycle to venture out to Arizona and ended up making Arizona his home. Mark was an avid hunter and hiker who loved the outdoors. In his free time, he was a volunteer sheriff for Coconino County. He was a giver to all who knew him, especially his family. Mark passed away peacefully, surrounded by family, on August 3rd, 2025, after fighting a short but courageous battle with cancer. He is survived by his loving wife, Rosalie, his daughter, Janelle, with Tony, grandsons, Joseph and Aiden, sisters, Diane, with Dave, Nancy, with Mike, nephews, Josh, Jesse, Ryan, nieces, Casey and Kristen, along with grandnieces and nephews. He is preceded in his death by his parents and brother Craig. At Mark's request, no services will be held. Condolences may be shared with the family at NorvalOwensMortuary.com. Moving along, we now have some local news briefs to read, written by Daily Sun staff. The first news brief is called Flagstaff Police Arrest Alleged Driver from Fatal Hit and Run. Okay, again, this is by Daily Sun staff. The Flagstaff Police Department announced on Tuesday that officers had identified and arrested a suspect from a fatal hit-and-run collision that occurred early in the morning near the intersection of 4th Street and Route 66. The department's press release stated that officers responded to the scene shortly before 3 a.m. for a report of a man lying in the road. That individual was identified as Christopher Charlie, 55, of Flagstaff. Charlie did not survive. Officers recovered vehicle debris from the site of the presumed collision and used recordings captured by Flagstaff's network of Flock automated license plate readers to quickly identify a suspect vehicle and its owner. Based on that information, Flagstaff Police located and arrested Christopher Miles Clark, 25. Clark was booked into the Coconino County Detention Facility just before 5 a.m. of charges of failure to stop at the scene of an injury collision and driving under the influence. The department noted that additional charges against Clark are pending. No additional details were immediately available. Police urged anyone with information about the incident to contact the department at 928-774-1414 or the Silent Witness tip line at 928-774-6111. And that brief was called Flagstaff Police Arrest Alleged Driver from Fatal Hit and Run. Our next news brief is called Nestle Purina Celebrates 50 Years in Flagstaff. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the opening of Nestle Purina's Flagstaff factory, the company announced on August 6th. We take immense pride in our factory's role within the community and in our associates' dedication to delivering high-quality pet food, factory manager Ramon Martinez said in a press release. This anniversary is a testament to our team's commitment and the lasting impact we've made in Flagstaff. According to the press release, Purina has invested more than $43 million into the Flagstaff facility over the past 5 years. The Flagstaff factory has also given back to the community during this time, contributing nearly $2 million in pet food and more than $212,000 in monetary donations to local organizations. The facility produces leading brands such as Dog Chow, Friskies, and One, and it has been a long-standing partner to local organizations, including High Country Humane Society, United Way, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, the Boys and Girls Club of Northern Arizona, Northern Arizona Leadership Alliance, Northern Arizona Manufacturers Partnership, STEM Sanagua Middle School, Economic Council of Northern Arizona, and Cancer Support Community. Flagstaff has been proud to be home to the Nestle Purina Flagstaff factory for 50 years. Liz Archuleta, President and CEO of United Way of Arizona, said in the announcement. They have been a cornerstone of our local economy, providing quality jobs, investing in workforce development, and supporting our community through charitable initiatives. Purina's commitment to the company, or to community, has created lasting opportunities for families and businesses alike. We congratulate Purina on this milestone and look forward to many more years of partnership and shared success. The Flagstaff factory employs approximately 320 people, and the company is currently hiring for both salaried and hourly positions. More information about current job openings is available at nestlejobs.com/locations/Flagstaff. Our next news brief is called County Appoints New Emergency Management Director. Coconino County announced Tim Carter's appointment as the new Emergency Management Director on Thursday, effective August 1st. It says Carter has a master's degree in emergency management and homeland security and is a certified emergency manager. With more than two decades of public safety experience, Carter has spent more than 13 years with Coconino County. Tim has demonstrated leadership in disaster response, hazard mitigation, stakeholder engagement, and public outreach, said Coconino County Manager Andy Bertelson. He is a strong leader who excels in interagency coordination, and we are fortunate to have him on our team. Prior to his role as Emergency Management Director, Carter worked in the department as a specialist and assistant director. As assistant director, he maintained interagency relationships, managed the emergency notification system, assisted with budget development, secured grant funding, and supervised members of the team. Before joining emergency management, Carter worked in adult probation and juvenile court. I am honored to be appointed as the Director of Emergency Management and grateful to the County Manager's Office for their confidence in my leadership, Carter said. I look forward to continuing our work to strengthen community-wide preparedness, enhance public safety, coordination, and ensure the safety and resilience of our residents and visitors in the face of potential hazards. Next, we have a brief called Coconino County Designates Friday, August 15th, as Stephen Bonilla Peru Day. A little more than a year since his second retirement as Coconino County Manager, Steve Peru returned to the podium in the county's administration building during the Board of Supervisors meeting on Tuesday. However, rather than providing context of comments on county business, Peru was offering thanks to a wide range of speakers as the board designated August 15th, 2025, as Stephen Bonilla Peru Day. I've had such a privilege of working with everyone, Peru said. There's just simply not enough time to acknowledge everyone by name, but there are so many stories that we all share together in this room. And of course, everyone on Zoom, and those are such good stories, of good times and bad. The proclamation recognized Peru's more than 35 years of service to Coconino County in various positions, ranging from his start as a service aide in the Community Services Department to his time as finance director and elections director, before ultimately serving as county manager on two occasions. The only county manager in recent history to serve in the position twice, initially from 2006 to 2011, and then again from 2021 to 2024, Peru led Coconino County through disastrous fires, tornadoes, and pandemic, all while completing projects like the new jail, rebuilt courthouse, new financial strategy, and redistricting. Awarded the John J. DeBlask Professional Excellence Award from the Arizona City County Management Association earlier this year, Peru also worked with the community for the United Way of Arizona, Coconino Community College, and W.L. Gore and Associates. For our elected and appointed leadership, I can't say enough how much I've appreciated your support, your feedback, and our ability to have at times courageous conversations, all in the goal of serving the public, Peru said. Next news brief we have is MNA offering free admission to NAU CCC students. The Museum of Northern Arizona, MNA, is offering free admission to students at Northern Arizona University and Coconino Community College for the upcoming school year. Students showing their valid ID for NAU or CCC at the front desk will receive free general admission to the museum between August 15th and May 15th, 2026. Professors at either institution can also arrange free tours or self-guided visit classes by filling out a request form at musnaz.org/plan-your-visit/tours. The student admission program is made possible through the support of an MNA donor. The museum is located at 3101 North Fourth Valley Road and is open daily from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. More information is available at musnaz.org. And I think this is the last news brief. We'll find out. It's called Sedona Heritage Museum Announces Return of Red Rock Loop Tour. The Sedona Heritage Museum will once again host its annual local history tours September 24th through the 27th. Visiting various historic sites, homesteads, and buildings along the Red Rock Loop Road. Sedona Heritage Museum historians will share stories of early settlers, wine history, homesteading, irrigation, and water rights, and much more. Tour participants will learn about the origins of Red Rock State Park and the House of Apache Fire within the park, built by aviation innovator Jack Fry and his wife Helen. The tour will include visits to the Chavez Homestead, Dumas Ranch, Shurman Red Rock Cemetery, Shurman Homestead House, the Armijo Homestead House, and the site of an early Oak Creek vineyard site of an early Oak Creek vineyard where Arizona's winery history began. Both the Shurman and Armijo homesteads are on the National Register of Historic Places. The tour will also stop at Crescent Moon Ranch via a permit issued from the Coconino National Forest. Tours are September 24th, 25th, 26th, and 27th from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Space is limited. Tour participants will have an opportunity to get off at various stops to explore some of the sites on foot and stretch their legs. Tickets are $75 for Sedona Historical Society members and $85 for non-members. Tickets are available at the museum or by calling 928-282-7038. And those were today's news briefs. Now we're going to read another local article that is from the Ask a Ranger series. It's called The Story Behind the Name of Happy Jack by Richard McGaw, special to the Daily Sun. Have you ever wondered how places get their names? Northern Arizona is full of colorful and curious place names, each with a story. One such story belongs to our city, Flagstaff, named after the limbing of a tall ponderosa and the raising of the Stars and Stripes to celebrate July 4th, 1876. That tree-turned landmark became a beacon for travelers moving west. But today I want to talk about another name with just as much character, Happy Jack. Where did this cheerful name come from? Some say it was inspired by a grinning hash knife cowboy nicknamed Happy Jack. Others claim it was a happy-go-lucky, perhaps slightly inebriated lumberjack who brought laughter to the logging camps. Yet another tale suggests it was named after an outlaw who robbed stagecoaches near Laramie, Wyoming. Let's set the stage. By the early 1940s, the Ponderosa forests around Flagstaff had been heavily harvested. The events of the 1930s and 1940s had taken a toll on the timber industry. With two of the Reardon brothers having passed away, the remaining brother decided it was time to retire after 44 years in the business. And in 1941, the Arizona Lumber and Timber Company and Central Arizona Railroad were leased to the Saginaw and Manistee Lumber Company, who took over the operations and changed the company name accordingly. To access new timber stands, the Central Arizona Railroad's Munns Park line was extended to Sheep Springs, bringing it closer to the area soon to be known as Happy Jack. The final 10-mile segment reached Allen's Lake, aka Allen's Landing. With fresh timber waiting, a new logging camp was established at Yellow Jacket Spring and was initially called Saginaw Camp. Locals knew the area as Onion Flat or Yellow Jacket Spring. Even in the late 1940s, signs along Lake Mary Road still used the older name, and you can still spot Yellow Jacket Spring today on Google Maps. The logging industry itself was changing. The 1930s and 1940s saw the introduction of trucks and bulldozers. A bulldozer could do in a day what once took a team of 30 men and horses a week. Now, timber could be hauled by truck to landings and loaded onto trains for transport to the sawmill. These are the kinds of stories John Cockrell has shared with me. John spent his childhood in Happy Jack during the mid-1940s. At its peak during the summer logging months, the camp housed nearly 500 residents. John's father, Phil Cockrell, was the engineer of a small steam engine nicknamed Two Spot, now parked near the Flagstaff train depot. Phil would ride out each morning to assist the big engine, the one on display in front of the Pioneer Museum, in pulling 30 cars loaded with yellow pine up and down steep mountain grades to the mill. So how did Saginaw and Manistee's Yellow Jacket Spring and Saginaw Camp become Happy Jack? When Forest Supervisor Roland Roddy decided he didn't like the name Yellow Jacket Camp, perhaps because there were already several by that name in the CNF, he asked the community for name suggestions. They responded with creative options. Bunyanburg, after the legendary Paul Bunyan. Yellow Pine, a nod to the vast Ponderosa forests. Ponderosa, what a bonanza. Dendropolis, meaning tree city. Or Arbor Urbay, excuse me, tree town. Bunyanburg was reportedly the most popular among locals, but in a classic example of bureaucratic fiat, Roddy overruled the suggestions and chose instead Happy Jack, the name of an area in Wyoming where he had previously lived. As it turns out, there really was a man behind the name. Jesse S. Happy Jack Hollingsworth, 1832 to 1909. In 1884, Hollingsworth settled near the Laramie Range in a modest adobe home. For many years, he hauled wood from the mountains into Cheyenne, always singing as he worked. People who knew him called him Happy Jack, a joyful, singing lumberjack. So perhaps the legends weren't so far-fetched after all. Whether outlaw, cowboy, or cheerful logger, Happy Jack's legacy lives on, not just in the forests and historic railroads of northern Arizona, but also and especially in the name of a hardworking community with a colorful past. And that was Ask a Ranger, The Story Behind the Name of Happy Jack by Richard McGaw, special to the Daily Sun. And that's all the time we have today for the Arizona Daily Sun. For Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff, I'm volunteer reader Lisa Cantor-Ganey. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great rest of your day. Take care.